want the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I've got a real treat for you today, a fascinating look behind the scenes at the Charlie Hebdo newspaper, which published the outrageous cartoons, including depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, that led to the January 7th attack on their offices in Paris. Bart Beatty is a professor of English, heads the department at the University of Calgary, and an acknowledged international expert on comics and political cartoons. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. It's brought to you by my listeners, people who support my work with your subscriptions, like Olivier de Merlu, who lives in Switzerland and apparently has two subscriptions. I just noticed that. So does Andy Krieger. They're very generous people. Along with Chris Welsh and Annette McManus, they support my work on a regular basis here, and I invite you to do the same. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, click on the sign-up link. That takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers get my bonus gift. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest book called Empire of Chaos. I'd love to send it to you, so please sign up today.
You're quite hostile.
I got a right to be hostile, man. My people been persecuted.
Public Enemy opens our podcast today as we get some expert commentary on the French magazine Charlie Hebdo and the January attacks on its offices in Paris. The Public Enemy tune is called Prophets. P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Prophets of Rage. And a prophet and rage play into the scene that took place in Paris in January of this year. Bart Beatty is a professor and, in fact, head of the English department at the University of Calgary in Canada. And I just happened to be in Eugene, Oregon 3 weeks ago when he gave a guest lecture. And I was on campus there leading a workshop about podcasting. And I found out at the last minute he was speaking, and I was able to drop into the session where he presented his commentary. And so, Professor, I'm very grateful that you can join us here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And just a little bit of background, you appear to be a worldwide expert on comic books and political cartoons, and you've just published a new volume about the Archie cartoons. Tell us a little bit about your own fascination with line drawings that contain potent messages.
Sure, yeah. I've published now 15 books on comics, edited anthologies, some translations of theoretical and historical works from French to English, and of course my own monographs. As you mentioned, my most recent is on the Archie comics of the 1960s, which is a very different topic than the one that we're talking about today.
But let's give it a proper plug here. It's called 12 Cent Archie, and it was just published by Rutgers, right?
That's right, Rutgers University Press.
Uh-huh.
And it's a kind of unusual academic book in that, insofar as it has 100 chapters dedicated to, you know, some of the big themes that are raised by the Archie comics of the 1960s, including the race relations as they exist in Riverdale and gender relations as they exist in the love triangle between Archie, Betty, and Veronica, and so on. But then also a lot of focused chapters on things like whatever happened to Archie's sweater vest, or why does Betty always wear her hair in a ponytail? What does that tell us about her character? So it's somewhat serious, as an academic book should be, but it's also a little bit on the frivolous side, as I think a study of Archie should be. Another one of my earlier books is a book that came out in 2007 from the University of Toronto Press, and that one's called Unpopular Culture, Transforming the European Comic Book in the 1990s. And it's a study of artists at that time, mostly in France and Belgium, but also elsewhere, Portugal, Finland, Germany, who were trying to make comic books a serious mode of expression, get rid of that frivolous side and prove that comic books can be used for virtually any topic. And so the way that they sought to challenge the traditions of cartooning was particularly of great interest to me. And it was through writing that book and my studies of European comics over the last 10 or 15 years that I got to know some of the cartoonists associated with Charlie Hebdo and their colleagues and some of the publishers that they work for, notably L'Association, which is a small press based in Paris, a small artist-run cooperative that has worked fairly extensively with Charlie Hebdo artists over the years.
Mm-hmm. And, Professor, before we dive into the Charlie Hebdo history and the violent episode, just a bit of an overview, because graphic novels have become a new phenomenon in English-language cultures. But I know that, animation and cartoon-type communications have been very popular in other cultures, notably in Japan. And also, you noted in your commentary in Eugene that France has a very rich 200-year history of very strident political cartooning. Give us a little global overview, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in France, the connection between editorial or political cartooning and comic books and graphic novels is much more fluid than it is in the United States or in Canada, where I am. I think in the United States, we have a long tradition of editorial cartoonists and some great editorial cartoonists, but they very, very rarely cross over into doing comic strips, which is seen as a separate art form, or comic books, which is, again, a separate art form. In France, those distinctions really aren't there, and so a cartoonist like George Walensky, who was one of the artists who was killed on January 7th, had a long career as an editorial cartoonist, but also a long career as a comic book artist. And those things were just seen as, you know, two sides of the same coin. You use the same skills and participate in the sort of same circulation and economy around Paris and its publishing industry. And it does go back much further. There is a long tradition in France of engaged political cartooning that goes right back to the pre-revolutionary days, and people will point to artists like Honoré Daumier, who was imprisoned for his caricatures of the King of France, and an entire tradition of kind of scatological and obscene presentations of Marie Antoinette that were, you know, are generally held by historians to have hastened the arrival of the French Revolution. Cartooning has a really strong power, especially at a time in the 18th century when most of the population wasn't literate. They weren't reading newspapers, but they could read cartoons. Mm-hmm. Cartoons, spoke in a very dramatic way and can cut very viscerally, very quickly. I think it's interesting, of course, that this entire situation that has arisen in Paris and has arisen in Copenhagen and so on stems from cartoons. It doesn't stem from long essays that are critical of the Prophet or critical of Islam. They stem from cartoons, which I think people assume that you can apprehend very, very quickly. A good cartoon, speaks to you in an instant, and you take in its meaning, and if it's a harsh political cartoon, you take in the bite very, very quickly. Whereas, essays are longer, you have to engage with them, and so on. And obviously, essayistic writing can also cause offense and can also cause, dramatic social change. Mm-hmm. But it takes longer to do so.
And if a picture can, serve as 1,000 words, a cartoon, with the right impact on the right pair of eyes, can speak volumes beyond 1,000 words.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that, you know, we use that in Picture's Worth a Thousand Words, and to the point that it's almost a cliche.
Yeah.
But there is an awful lot of truth to it, as we see. I mean, you watch social media, the way that people will circulate images and memes and simply pictures that are being repurposed and so on Twitter and Facebook and so on in order to make political points about their opponents. There's a real strength to that, and I think a lot of people are recognizing the strength that's implicit in the image.
And separate from the line drawing is the humor that is, the creative process, the creative payload, if you will, that comes from the mind of the artist.
Right.
And that humor, as twisted, as cynical, as decadent, as scatological as it might be, is deeply reflective of that individual's expression.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the Charlie Hebdo artists, people in the wake of the tragedy, a lot of people began to talk about the magazine, the newspaper, as a singularity, that they had a kind of single point of view. And that's really, you know, never been my case as someone that read and kept up with the newspaper at all. There was, you know, they very much had, there was eight cartoonists who were sort of the core. There were others that contributed over time. And that core had a similar sensibility across the work, but there were always, you know, very clear individual differences in the way that Sharp would approach a topic compared to Cabu or to Walensky, and so on. And that wasn't just reflected in the different ways that they drew, but then also in how far they were willing to push things or what their particular, the particular topics that they would come back to time and time again. So Walensky and Cabu were both of the 60s generation and, you know, tended to use gender in a lot more of their cartoons, a lot more sex than some of the more contemporary, the younger cartoonists working for the newspaper did, for instance. And you could always kind of imagine how they might approach it. And that was the function, absolutely, of their own individual voices as cartoonists and as artists.
And one of the things that really stayed with me from the presentation that you made, Professor, is the ensemble nature of the Charlie Hebdo team. And from my own experience, I've worked at times as a disc jockey on music stations and as a talk show host on AM stations. And in each case, you present the image of kind of a family, your buddies, you know, and you rib one another. And there's also a kind of sharing. At the same time, your own ego surfaces during your particular time period. And what you showed us is that this was a very collective effort, and they would meet and draw and post things and then as a group decide what was going to be the cover cartoon, and then many of the rest of them were depicted on the back page. So, you know, many of these expressions maybe that didn't make it to primetime on the front cover, nevertheless, were honored by being published and being able to reach at least a partial audience.
Yeah, for the Charlie Hebdo artists, every week, the most important image was always the cover image. That's the one that's going to sell the magazine. The covers obviously play an important role in marketing magazines, but also setting the tone for what's inside. And they would meet every Wednesday afternoon, and they would, you know, their new issue would come out on Wednesday, and so they would meet to start planning the next one, and they would sit around a big table, and they would say, well, what are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about the president? Are we going to talk about the American president? Are we going to talk about what's in the news this week? And they would begin drawing, and there's a documentary that's being made about them, and you can see this process of just sort of joking back and forth, and one of them will draw a cartoon, put a caption to it, somebody will suggest a funnier caption to it, they'll redraw, they'll say, you know, this would be funnier if you did it this way, and so on. And over a period of several hours, they would generate dozens of cartoons, and they just kind of pin them up to the wall. And by the end, they're all sitting around, and they're smoking, and they're drinking wine, and they're they're laughing with each other and trying to make each other laugh, which is the goal of a humor magazine. And then they would sort of pick one. They would say, well, you know, that's the one. That's the best idea here. that's what we're going to go with, and then that would be, you know, colored and done in a final version, and then used as a cover. And then they would always put the kind of failures on the back cover, and the joke was, these are the covers from which you have been spared. but of course you haven't been spared, because there they are in front of you. But it was very much a kind of collaborative, jokey atmosphere that, you know, you imagine probably exists around the writer's table for a television show or mm-hmm. Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. where they all come in and they pitch some ideas for what they're going to do this week, and then they finally suddenly go, you know what, that's the best idea. That's going to be the lead sketch, because that's really the funniest thing we've got going on this week.
So it was
that meeting that was the one that was attacked, that people knew that that's when they would all be there. And so the killers came at that moment, because they knew that's when all the artists would be in the office. Because for the most part, of course, the rest of the week they weren't in the office. They would work from home and just do their individual contribution.
Now, using your comparison to Saturday Night Live, there's a very strong producer there, Lorne Michaels, who would make the judgments about, okay, what's going to be our opening segment to get people's attention, you know, what sketches get green-lighted and which ones get killed. Was there a top dog at Charlie Hebdo, or was it much more French socialist style based on consensus?
Yeah, I think they're probably a little bit more anarchic than Saturday Night Live would be, based on what I've read about working on Saturday Night Live. You know, they did have an editor, and that was Sharb, and he was one of the cartoonists who died. And they've had various other editors at different points in their history. They had, you know, I think they had a very strong editor publisher, Philippe Val, for a number of years in the 1990s, and he left the magazine to go into television, actually a number of years ago. And I think you can look at the evolution of the newspaper over time, and you can see something of the editorial, the editor's hand in shaping the subjects that were going to be talked about, the cartoonists who were going to work there. Somebody is making hiring decisions and so on. Ultimately, no matter how kind of apolitical and anarchic and socialist and egalitarian you want to be, somebody does have to make a decision about who's getting how many column inches in any given newspaper. They only have 16 pages every week, and so in recent years that has been Sharb, and he was quite an acidic cartoonist, very, very much politically on the left, a kind of active communist, not just a socialist or a liberal, mm-hmm. but an active member of the Parti Communiste Français, and who had really, I think, a kind of anarchist value of we will attack all forms of authority, and I think the magazine had increasingly reflected that over the last decade or so.
I'm talking with Bart Beatty. He's a professor of English, head of the English department at the University of Calgary. And, Professor, if you'll indulge me for a minute, let me just offer a couple of quick thumbnails of American publications and ask you to contrast, compare them with Charlie Hebdo. The New Yorker has the longest tradition of using cartoon art for its cover, and a large number of cartoons in the interspersed with the editorial. Mad Magazine is a pure cartoon publication. I haven't read it in many years. I'm not even sure it's still published, but I read it religiously as a teenager and a kid. It was always around our house, and it was fun, but I recall the Spy versus Spy cartoon series was the one that came closest to being political, and it was operating only on the spoof level. And the most unrestricted cartooning that I've seen in an American publication is in Larry Flint's porn magazine called Hustler. And he has gone to the very edge of taking public figures like Pat Robertson and, cartooning him up as the asshole of the month. And so with that range that would be familiar to my American listeners, how would you describe Charlie Hebdo and the elements that it published on a weekly basis?
I would actually say in some ways Charlie is closer to the Hustler tradition than it is certainly to the New Yorker. The New Yorker is a sort of middle brow respectable magazine that, although it does engage in political commentary occasionally on their covers, that's definitely the minority of their covers. And I think people, you know, kind of perk up their ears when the New Yorker actually takes a stand through one of their covers and doesn't just do a sort of falling leaves for fall cover. Mad, I think, had some of the anarchic spirit of Charlie Hebdo, particularly in the 1950s and the 1960s, particularly where they would aim their ire at the advertising culture that's so dominant in North America and make fun of television, radio, mm-hmm. print ads, and so on. That kind of bite to Mad, although Mad was always aimed at a much younger audience. Charlie Hebdo is really, you know, it's a cartoon magazine primarily for adults. It's not generally appropriate for, certainly not for young children at all, but maybe not even for young teenagers, and so on. They're very hard-hitting in the way that Hustler is, the way that Al Goldstein's Screw was, mm-hmm. but more political in a lot of ways, and less kind of, you know, Hustler and Screw, obviously a lot of kind of gratuitous sexuality in those cartoons that would crop up from time to time in Charlie Hebdo, but was never the dominant thread. They were not that interested in the pornographic or the erotic, although they would use that as one of their weapons from time to time against their enemies, and they loved to depict Marine Le Pen, for instance, the leader of the you know, anti-immigrant National Front in France, in pornographic poses, mm-hmm. in the same way that Flint would do that against his enemies as well. So, yeah, there is no real American equivalent to Charlie Hebdo, partly because there is no, you know, equivalent to the kind of left-wing politics, the organized left-wing politics that exist in France. I mean, it's hard, I think, for Americans to appreciate sometimes that there is an actual Communist Party in France, and it does actually get significant numbers of votes. And there is an actual Socialist Party in France, and they actually do hold the presidency at the current moment. So, you know, in that context, you have a magazine like Charlie Hebdo, which is mostly people who are sympathetic to the Communist Party of France, but are also willing to go further to the left in a lot of cases than that party is in terms of attacking their enemies. And that kind of, we will destroy everyone. We want no allies. It's interesting that the cover of their new issue, now that they've come back after their hiatus, so they had the one that sold the millions of copies, mm-hmm. but their first regular one now is a picture of Charlie Hebdo as a dog that's being chased by all these other dogs. And it's all the people that are their friends and their enemies. Their enemies that want to destroy them and the friends that seem to want to rescue them. And Charlie Hebdo seems to want to be the dog that just wants to be left alone maybe for a moment now. But they really, in a lot of ways, were a magazine that didn't want allies. They, you know, anybody that you know, would embrace Charlie Hebdo was probably the next person to be attacked by Charlie Hebdo.
Well, and that is the fascinating thing about extreme satire, is that in some ways, and you addressed this when I heard you speak before, their cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad were in some ways a recognition that Muslims are full members of French society.
Yeah.
And you discussed in your portion that you called the political frame that Charlie Hebdo has been routinely anti-Catholic, which, of course, is the dominant both cultural and religious identity in France. And that in many ways, their decision to include Muslims, including the iconic prophet, as part of their repertoire was recognition that Muslims are a significant portion of French the French population and its current culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly the way that they would explain it. I think it's important to note that, you know, in the debate about Charlie Hebdo that erupted in the United States, which was often a debate that was being held by people who hadn't read the magazine, unfortunately, were some of the loudest voices in that debate. There was often people who are critical of the magazine and their depiction of Muslims or the depiction of Islam or the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad would say, well, this is a, you know, it's a hate-mongering magazine. It's important to remember that France has anti-hate speech laws. They have very aggressive anti-hate speech laws that are both criminal and civil. So you can sue someone for hate speech, but they can also be charged criminally for hate speech. Charlie Hebdo was brought up on has gone through 14 trials for hate speech. 13 times they've been charged by the Catholic Church or by its representatives or members of the Catholic religion for their depiction of God and Jesus and the Pope, who each of the popes is incredibly savage. I mean, they are very, very, very anti-clerical from that standpoint. They were charged once by Muslim organizations in France for their reprinting of the Danish cartoons, which they did in 2006. The original cartoons were published in 2005 in Denmark, and the cover that they added. And they were acquitted in each of these trials. I mean, France has very, very clear prohibitions against hate speech, but Charlie Hebdo has never fallen afoul of those laws. They know where those laws are, and they see what they do within a context, within a kind of appropriate context of contempt for the powerful and for people who are trying to control the lives of others. And they're very, very careful, I think, to not direct their ire at particular ethnic groups or peoples as a whole. It's always, you know, they're not, their cartoons where they deal with Muslims are not about Muslims per se. They may be about ISIS, for example. They may be about specific Muslim spokespeople and specific imams, just as they're not anti-Catholic per se, that is opposed to the average Catholic on the street, but they're opposed to the Pope or to the bishop or to individual people who might be in the news at any given time. Their satire was really very, very focused, and it wasn't just sort of a general, well, we don't like Catholics or Jews or whatever group. I think they would have found that those kinds of cartoons very, very simplistic, and Charlie Hebdo was never simplistic in their humor. They could be crude, but they would use that crudity knowingly as a blunt force kind of trauma, but they could also be very, very sophisticated in some of their jokes. And I think this is where some of the confusion enters into the debate, is people not fully getting all of the context of a joke.
Well, this is very important. You expressed your own difficulty, and you spent a lot of time in France. You know or knew many of the cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo. You're quite familiar with their range of sensibilities, if you will. And you conceded that many of the cartoons, you know, just don't make sense to you because you don't understand the specific context of the news event or other trigger that provoked that creative expression.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's difficult. It's almost impossible to read editorial cartoons in a different culture because, you know, what we might know of France, if we're lucky, is we know the name of the president and the prime minister and maybe a couple of the opposition. But, you know, do you know off the top of your head the name of the French education minister or the French cultural minister or the French defense minister? And if you don't know their names, if you don't know what they look like, and if you don't know what their policies are and how there might be, you know, internecine arguments within the party and so on, it becomes very, very difficult to read the humor there. If you aren't familiar with the debates were going on in France in that particular week, you're probably lost. When I was in Eugene, I picked up their morning paper, and I looked at the editorial cartoon, and it was a picture of a man, and he was being choked by this woman. It was kind of hanging around his neck, and I thought, I have no idea who this is. I don't know if this is the governor of Oregon. I don't know if it's the mayor of Eugene. I don't know if this is a counselor. I don't know if it's his wife. I have no idea. And I'm sure that was a very transparent cartoon to anybody that lives in Eugene, and they could have explained it to me, but the key was they would have had to explain it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just as if I showed you the cartoon in the Calgary Herald today, you would have no idea because you don't know who our mayor is, you don't know what the debates in council have been this week. And so our sense that cartoons travel much more quickly than essays and can be, you know, apprehended and understood very quickly, I think that is partly true. But of course, if a work is drawing on multiple contexts, if it's making a joke about a cabinet minister by also referring to another scandal that doesn't involve that cabinet minister, that you're liable to misread unless you're able to get both of those contexts at the same time. And Charlie Hebdo would sometimes make it more complicated because they would refer to three stories at the same time. And so some of the cartoons where people would be picking them apart on social media and saying, well, you know, this seems to me like an anti-Muslim cartoon, you'd say, no, that's in fact referring to the fact that this particular politician is himself anti-immigrant, and it's also commenting on this change to the tax law at this time and so on. I mean, until you understand that context, it's very difficult to be able to judge what they're doing as a magazine.
Professor Beattie, one of the elements of analysis that I picked up from you that really stayed with me is the kind of analysis of satire and what you described as the kind of baseline rule that satire should punch upward. Explain that to my listeners, please.
That's something that I think a line of argument that's become very common in the last few years, that satire, the best satire punches upward. And so what that means is that the satirist's role is to attack the people, organizations that are more powerful than he or she is, and that's fine. To do a satire of President Obama is fine because President Obama has a lot of power, but to do a satire of a homeless person is not fine because a homeless person is the least powerful person in American society. And so if you're picking on a marginalized group, if you're picking on immigrant populations, if you're picking on people that generally have very little social capital, that's not an apt target for satire. And so Jonathan Swift can attack the English in his day, but to attack the Irish would have been unfortunate. This has become a very, very kind of common line of argumentation, I think, around social media. I think at first glance it holds a lot of value. You think, that makes a lot of sense. I agree with that. You shouldn't pick on people that are weaker than you are. That simply makes you a bully. And, and there's the cartoonist's role or the critic's role is to speak truth to power. And I think all of those things seem kind of, commonsensical to us. But I think when you actually begin to look at cartoons, you start to you end up having to ask yourself, well, what do we mean by a powerful group? And so I think in Eugene I used the example of cartoons that make fun of people who don't vaccinate their children. And you have to ask the question, are people who are opposed to vaccination a powerful group or not a powerful group? Well, some of them clearly do this because they have a misunderstanding of the science of vaccination, and so maybe they're less educated, in which case they're they're not a powerful group, and that would be punching down. But there's a lot of studies that show, in fact, a lot of the people who refuse vaccination are some of the most educated people in American society, in which case maybe it's punching up. And so that confusion around that issue, or, can you attack, can you do an editorial cartoon or satire against the Tea Party? Is that punching up or down? Do they have power in American society, or don't they have power in American society? I think you need a very sophisticated understanding of power, and I think you need a sophisticated understanding, again, of the context. And so I think a lot of cartoonists would simply say, you know what, that's you're handcuffing us here in ways that maybe aren't appropriate. And so the commonsensical reading of what is up and what is down, I think needs to be problematized a little bit, and not just taken for granted that, there are certain topics that we can't talk about using satire. I think Charlie Hebdo, absolutely, the cartoonist would have said, no, there's nothing that we can't satirize, and there's nothing that we will not satirize. This is a magazine that published on their cover the week after the attacks on 9/11 an image of the plane flying into the towers with a stockbroker screaming sell, which is an incredibly tasteless cartoon, particularly at that day and time. But can I interject?
Let me interject, okay? Because on September 11th, as it happened, I was in Spain, And the only English language coverage that I could get of the events in the United States was on CNBC Europe. And while they would cut to the main NBC network for updates, they were mainly trying to gauge the implications on markets.
Right.
And this was within several hours of the attacks and the towers coming down in New York. And so I am not personally offended by that cartoon you just described, because it speaks to an experience that I had.
Right. Yeah, and I think, obviously, you know, this is a magazine that tries to offend first and foremost. Well, actually, I wouldn't say first and foremost. I would say they don't try to offend first and foremost. They try to be funny first and foremost. And if they offend, well, that's kind of too bad. They're willing to do that. But, yeah, I think that's a kind of cover, though, that I can't imagine an American magazine publishing at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was completely outside the boundaries of what in the United States would have been considered good taste, and probably for a lot of people in France would have been considered good taste as well. But it's just an example, I think, of the way that they go straight for the jugular. They just sort of, what is the weak point here? And they have no fear about pushing those buttons.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor, I want to talk about the reaction to the attack and the killings. And, you know, we saw this hastily arranged so-called peace march, which I think was anything but. And we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu was asked not to come to Paris. And then when he found out that Avigdor Lieberman, who remarkably is further to the right than Netanyahu, was going to be in Paris, then Bibi said, okay, I don't care what the French say, I'm coming.
Right.
And we know, for example, that the picture that was on front pages and on television news the following day showed these world leaders, including Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas and Angela Merkel, with, you know, locked arms as they're marching. And we're told that they led the parade of 3 million people down the Champs-Élysées. But the next day or two, social media brought us the aerial photo of that photo op. That really displayed the hypocrisy, that they were standing and maybe there were 200 people behind them, and then it was just a big, wide, open space. They were not, in fact, leading the march. And so while the world has paid lip service to free expression, this has been used as a photo op. Netanyahu used it for a sweeping denunciation of all of his perceived enemies. And it has been seized upon and used in many ways that I find quite distasteful.
Yeah, I mean, it immediately, an event like this immediately falls into a series of frames and narratives that get deployed very, very quickly, and often for political purposes. I mean, a lot of the initial reaction in France was, oh, this is going to bolster the Front National, the anti-immigrant extreme right-wing party in that country. And then you got, you know, this gathering of hundreds of world leaders, many of whom had imprisoned journalists in their own countries, coming together to celebrate the freedom of the press. So the hypocrisy was really astounding. And, you know, the surviving Charlie Hebdo artists were quite blunt about recognizing that hypocrisy. Willem, the Dutch cartoonist who wasn't at the meeting, said, you know, very bluntly, we vomit on our new supporters. We, you know, we did not want them. They're not our friends. They were never our friends. And we don't want their support. The widow, one of the widows wrote after the march, the highlight of the entire march was when the French president, François Hollande, came to give his condolences to her that a bird crapped on him. Mm-hmm. And she thought that was the best thing that could have possibly happened, because that's what they would have liked to happen to this guy, is that they crapped on him as well. And they don't really want his condolences. You know, that wasn't a magazine for him, and it wasn't a magazine that supports him. And so, but of course it was you know, 3 million people coming together, and there are very few politicians that can resist that opportunity to get involved, even in a kind of very manipulated way, as we were revealed by the photos that were taken from a greater vantage point, that we saw that this was a made-up media event, in the same way that the toppling of the Saddam Hussein statues were in Iraq, that once you pull back the camera a little bit, you see, oh, well, actually, this is not not a spontaneous event that's happening. It's something that's being done for the cameras and exclusively for the cameras.
Now, from your perch north of our border, offer your comments on the way the American media handled this and the fact that to date the New York Times has not been willing to publish a single one of the prophet cartoons in the newspaper. And while Americans can find all of this online, the corporate media organs have, you know, given full throat to freedom of expression, but they're not willing to publish these cartoons.
Yeah, that hypocrisy has been really, really striking. I won't say as a Canadian that, you know, we've done a better job. Our national newspapers have responded the same way, and the television networks in Canada responded the same way. There was a good tally that one website put up about the way the different countries were dealing with this, and which publications were, you know, willing to run the material and which ones weren't. It was really fascinating. Of course, when they came back, and so they did the special issue, the one that sold 3 million copies, that had another picture of the Prophet Muhammad on the cover, and the story there, you know, the New York Times and others said, well, the story is not the original cartoons, the story is the massacre itself, and so therefore we don't have to sell show the cartoons. That's not an argument that I find credible, but it's at least an argument. You could at least argue that, and I think believe it. But when they came back and the story was, hey, they're back and they've got this new issue and so on, then the story is, in fact, that they're back and that they have an issue, and the cover itself is the main part of the story. And so to not show that, I think was incredibly problematic. And the coy way that a number of them have dealt with it, I just saw a piece in The Guardian, actually, where they were talking about the sales of that issue in the UK, and they show somebody holding it, but it's only the very top, and it's the kind of green background and the title, but you don't get to see any of the image. And they're like, oh, it's like they're, it's remarkable. It's almost a tease that, you know, we'll show that we can show the magazine that it actually exists, we just won't show you what's on it. Or, of course, if you just Google it, it comes up, the first million hits are these images. So they're not hidden, but they won't participate in them. Very few Canadian newspapers were willing to do it either, and very few in the United States were, and actually all around the world there were papers that still backed away from this, even in the aftermath of these multiple deaths.
And do you see any wisdom in restraint, trying not to, spur another cycle of violence?
I actually don't, because I think in a lot of ways you're just making it worse. You're just making these, reifying the idea that these images are taboo, and I'm not entirely convinced that they are. And so you're just hiding behind these things. I don't think if the New York Times had run that cover, the New York Times was in danger of being attacked any more than the New York Times is probably in danger of being attacked on any given day as a target. I don't think they're setting themselves up, and I don't think that the magazines that did print the cartoons back in the day, Harper's, for example, which published them in 2006, nothing has happened to Harper's for publishing the original Danish cartoons, which they did with annotations by the cartoonist Art Spiegelman, who was very critical of the cartoons, but they ran them in order to criticize them and subject them to scrutiny. I think that's a perfectly appropriate approach. If you're the New York Times and editorially, you think that there should be no depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, if you believe with that particular interpretation of the Quran, then say so, but engage in the criticism, engage in the dialogue. Hiding parts of what you're talking about from your readers is basically telling your readers that you don't think very much of them.
Well said. Professor, as we wrap up, I wonder if you could share with my listeners a few just personal comments on the artists who were killed on January 7th. because you knew many of them. And I really think it's important to help people understand who they were and, you know, what we have lost.
Yeah, I mean, the cartoonists who died were all in various ways a significant group of cartoonists. So George Walensky, who was one of the five who died, who was with the magazine really from its beginnings in the 1960s. Charlie Hebdo grew out of a kind of humor tradition, a magazine called Harakiri in France, and in 1969 went from a monthly to a weekly as Harakiri Hebdo. That magazine was then shut down. It was actually censored by the French government when they made fun of the death of Georges Pompidou, Charles de Gaulle.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a kind of step too far, and it was reborn weeks later as Charlie Hebdo. And it survived from 1969 to the early 1980s when it went bankrupt and then was brought back in the 90s. Walensky was one of the cartoonists who's kind of there from day one. He was an incredibly celebrated cartoonist. In France, the Angoulême Comics Festival, which is the biggest comic festival in Europe every year, they have an honorary presidency. It's sort of like the Cannes Film Festival of comics. It's mm-hmm. in a small medieval town rather than on the Riviera. It tells you all you need to know about the difference between comics and film. but they select an honorary president every year, and it's the highest award that you can win in French cartoonists. And Walensky had won that award and was also given some of the highest civilian awards that you can get in France. An incredibly funny cartoonist who worked as an editorial cartoonist for the French Communist newspaper as well as for Charlie Hebdo. Cabu, who was also there from the beginning, was also one of the grand old men of the magazine, was also very, very well known as an editorial cartoonist, but also as a cartoonist, a creator of graphic novels, comic books and graphic novels in the 1970s, and helped usher in a kind of new realism into the art form at that day. Sharb was the editor-in-chief. He was a notable anti-racist activist for many years. He worked for an anti-racism non-governmental organization before joining Charlie Hebdo full-time and then working his way up to becoming the editor of that magazine. He was one of the most militant about drawing images of the Prophet, and in fact collaborated. He did the art for a history, a life history of the Prophet in the comics form, which is not satirical at all. It's just more or less a straight comic book telling of the life of the Prophet Muhammad done in comics form, which was actually published, I think, to very little fanfare a few years ago in France. It wasn't seen as particularly controversial.
Mm.
Honoré was, to my mind, the most interesting visual stylist of the cartoonists who died that day. I've always been a huge fan of the way he draws, the way he makes his work look like it was woodcuts, and so on. He had sort of less of a career in comic books and more worked more in illustration, but had beautiful, beautiful drawings. And then finally, Ting Yu was a cartoonist who was very, in a lot of ways, was sort of the exemplary Charlie Hebdo cartoonist. They tended to draw in a kind of what we call a Bigfoot style, that very cartoony big nose. The Simpsons mm-hmm. is sort of in that style, where the characters don't look like actual humans. They're not drawn in a realist way. And Tinu was a great exemplar of that tradition of cartooning. There was, you know, they were all very, very funny. There was one of the cartoon responses that I saw. Social media, of course, lit up immediately with all kinds of cartoonists who were drawing cartoons in solidarity and in sympathy. And the most common tended to be a broken pencil or a pencil turned into a Kalashnikov or erasing a Kalashnikov and so on. I saw a great cartoon which was somebody looking at these online and saying, well, broken pencil is not very funny. A broken pencil is not very funny. It's all these things are the same. And the cartoonist asks, where are the great cartoonists to really bring some humor to this situation. And then he pauses and thinks, oh, right. And in some ways, that was it. It was like these were the guys who were really well-positioned, who you would want to hear speak on something like this, because they would have found, I think, incredibly funny and witty and somewhat disturbing ways to talk about what had happened to them.
Well, Professor, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with my listeners. Is there anything you'd like to add about Charlie Hebdo, about the events of January 7th, or anything else that we didn't get to touch on?
No, I would just try to remind people that Charlie Hebdo is a very complicated magazine. It's had a lot of different cartoonists over its 40-year history, taking on a lot of different issues over its lifespan. And if you're interested in following up with Charlie Hebdo, my advice is always to read editorial cartoonists in their context and to make sure that when you're looking at a cartoon, and if you think, this doesn't sit well with me, this doesn't sit easily with me, ask yourself why that is and what's going on and what's trying to be communicated here. And ask yourself, do you have all the information you need in order to draw a conclusion about what's being said? Because I think there was a rush to judgment in a lot of corners about what Charlie Hebdo was, and their legacy got kind of turned on their heads in a lot of ways, in a lot of social media commentary. And I found that, personally, quite frustrating to read. And so, I think whenever something like this happens, I think you have to step back a little bit and try to look at the work dispassionately and try and really fully engage with what's being said and what's being done and understand the history of these cartoonists.
Bart Beatty, thanks for joining us today, professor of English, head of the English department at the University of Calgary, and the author of the new book called 12 Cent Archie. Should be available at your local bookstore. Check it out. Thank you, professor.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. Why don't you send me a political cartoon? Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.